Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Tommy is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
And we have a new co-host on the show.
That's right.
Welcome to the first time, for the first time, to Sawbones, Cooper McElroy.
Our plan is that she will be a silent
participant.
Third co-host, yeah. But that may not work out.
Yes, but we will do our best to limit the amount of contribution, because she doesn't know anything. That's the thing. She'll just start bloviating, and it's like, you don't know what you're talking about. You've only been outside 4 times.
But she really fancies herself an expert.
That's the problem.
That's the thing.
That's the problem.
That confidence. She has all the confidence.
Yes.
Of Justin, mm-hmm. but none of the knowledge of Sydney. So she's you?
I guess
she's just you.
She poops her pants more.
Okay, well, that has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about this week.
No, but we thought we should warn you.
Yeah. Justin, I thought we should talk about ambulances. I got no other lead in than that.
Yeah, well, it's a part where we've talked about a lot of parts of the medical experience. You get sick at home. Mm-hmm. You go to the hospital, get treated. What's in between there? What are you skipping?
Well, and the thing is, we've had a lot of people request this. And then the other thing is, I started to wonder, when did we decide, you know, there was a moment where there were house calls that doctors
right.
made. But when did we start taking sick people to doctors?
I guess the question is, when did you get too lazy to go to people's houses?
That's really what it is.
That's really what it is. Although you do that sometimes, right? All right, so now we're back. There was a brief moment there where you probably heard our daughter pooped her pants, and I left it in there just to let you know sort of what our day-to-day is like.
The sound, not the poop. The poop we did not leave in there.
No, we did not leave in there. So you were saying, Sid, I'm so sorry to have interrupted.
You asked me, do I do home visits? Yes, I have done home visits. I do that on occasion. But I think the difference is home visits used to be... in part because, and we'll get into this more, the stuff that a doctor could bring to your house was like not necessarily any less effective or helpful than the stuff they had in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there wasn't a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There weren't a lot of interventions that could be done. So
what's the difference?
You didn't lose anything by having the doctor come to your house.
Right.
Now, obviously there's a lot more that can be done for you in a hospital.
Right.
So let's get into the history of ambulances. And thank you, Eric, Richard, Ruth, and Sarah, for mentioning this. And I should go ahead and preface, a lot of other people have asked for the history of EMTs and, you know, EMS workers. That's a whole other story. And we will do an episode on that. But I'm not going to get into that because that's a whole story unto itself.
Okay.
So just a preface, I'm not ignoring that history. I just think, you know, it's a whole other episode.
All right. Got it.
So we have had some sort of medical transport device since ancient times. Since the first time somebody got injured or wounded, it usually on the battlefield would be the first good example of that. And everybody went, whoa, how do we get them out of here?
Right. We want them. We've got other things to do.
Yeah,
we can't have them lying around bleeding.
Get them out of here. Somebody had to come up with something. So the Greeks and the Romans would use chariots, you know, if you managed to survive or if you were wounded or injured or something. In another accident, not battle. In 900 CE, wagons with hammocks between them were introduced.
That is terrifying.
Yes, it was not great because, as you can imagine, taking a big curve or going downhill,
and they would have to go the same speed, I guess.
Yeah. So this was a bad solution.
That's a bad solution.
Yes.
Wow, that's like, that's spectacularly bad.
It's weird how you see these kinds of devices that, like, well, I mean, obviously just tossing somebody in a chariot that was really made for sitting or standing and then laying down is not really what it's for, but you could repurpose it.
But like turning
that's
it into
still
a,
better than
turning
this.
It into a stunt. Turning yeah. it into an Evel Knievel style death tempter.
They just really wanted you to earn it. So like you've survived your battlefield wound. Now can you survive the transport back?
Right.
We don't have any real medicine to give you anyway, so.
Spoiler alert.
In 1100, the Normans introduced the horse litter, which was just a bed suspended between two horses.
So Norman Lear, Norman Reedus got together, and they were like, listen, this is a, we've been doing this so poorly.
Well, I don't know that it's too much better.
It's between a bed suspended between two horses.
Than between two wagons.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it might be a little more manageable to keep two horses mm-hmm. in pace.
That'd be a rocky ride.
Yeah.
Be very bouncy, I would think. In the 1400s, we see the first concept of what we think of as like, of where the word ambulance came from.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these weren't actually vehicles or modes of transport necessarily. An ambulance or an ambulancia. Mm-hmm. They were basically like tents with surgical and medical supplies in them.
Okay.
Almost kind of like a MASH kind of thing.
Right.
So it wasn't actually a mobile, I mean, you could move it, but it wasn't for moving people.
It wasn't a transport.
It was not a transport, but
portable.
That's was the first use of the term ambulance.
Okay.
That's where it is derived from now. They were first used in 1487 during the siege of Malaga in Spain. But they had these like tents closer so that you had like medical equipment. Basically, it was just a way of getting medical equipment closer to the wounded people
mm-hmm.
as opposed to far away. But they didn't actually move any of the wounded until after the battle was over.
So it's kind of a question of if you're bringing the hospital to the patient or bringing the patient to the hospital. And
right.
More the former.
And this was sort of like an in-between measure because you didn't bring the medical care all the way to the patient. The patient still had to make their way to the tent.
Right.
And there was no defined method for doing that at the time. So they didn't wait. They didn't do it till the battle was over, which, you know, like if a battle could go on for days.
Yeah.
You better hope you were wounded the last day. Some big improvements were made with the French surgeon Dominique Jean Leray. We've talked about him before. He was Napoleon's doctor.
Okay.
And he saw that there was an opportunity to probably save more lives on the battlefield. And a lot of this is military history, because as you can imagine, that's where the urgent need for ambulances and some sort of medical transport first arose.
Right.
You know, but he saw that there were people on the battlefield who would be wounded. And if you could get them medical care faster, probably would survive. But as a result of having no defined method to transfer them from the battlefield or to bring medical care to them, people were dying.
Okay.
And so he thought we could improve survival if we could get these people who are wounded off the battlefield and to doctors faster.
Agreed.
So he developed these little carts with two wheels that were light and easy to transport on and off the battlefield quickly. And you could run them out there, load up a patient, and run them back off the battlefield.
So like a wheelbarrow. I mean, basically made a wheelbarrow.
I mean, they could also be pulled by horses.
Right.
Or
lots
mules
of
or camels,
can.
Depending
sure.
on where
yeah.
you
anything
were.
Yeah, anything that pulls stuff, it's still a wheelbarrow.
You could also bring the surgeons to the wounded this way.
Okay.
So you could say, hop on,
get
doc.
On board. Oh, man. Well, do y'all do that with the helicopter? Do the helicopters bring the doctors as patient, or they bring
there are,
the doctor?
There are both.
Okay.
Both can happen. And in transport, there's always, whether or not there's an actual physician, there's always somebody, like there are transport nurses whose mm-hmm. job it is just to like stabilize and provide medical care for patients in flight.
Okay.
They're flight nurses. We often will refer to them. And then there are obviously
sky nurses
like,
would be cooler if you're looking for a cooler one.
That would be cool. And also EMTs obviously provide the service. So there are a lot of medical personnel that aren't physicians who can provide this care. And I think I've said this before on the show, but I should reinforce it's not because, well, you're in an ambulance or a helicopter, so we're not going to give you a doctor. A lot of the time, the things you might need in that sort of emergent situation, EMTs and people who are trained specifically, like flight nurses, transport nurses and things, mm-hmm. are specifically, like, that is what they do all day, is stabilize emergent, like, trauma patients and people who are outside of the hospital, pre-hospital patients. They do that constantly. They're really good at it.
So if,
don't need me in that situation. I mean, I manage blood pressure and diabetes most of my day. You don't want me. You want the EMT. You want that transport
person. People are like, is there a doctor in the house? Should they be asking for an EMT?
If there's an EMT, a lot of time they're going to be probably better suited. I mean, if there's some sort of intense diagnostic process, I don't want to short sell what we can do as doctors. Like, I can assess people, and I have some training in global health and wilderness medicine, so I'm probably a little better suited than the average bear. But that being said, if I see a car crash on the side of the road and EMTs are there, they don't need me. All I'll do is interfere. I'm not pulling
over.
If I see
a bear there, I'm going to tell them that is unacceptable. It's just not cricket.
They do this kind of stuff all the time. They're more suitable.
Bears?
No, not bears.
Okay.
If there's a bear there, I'm probably not going to stop.
An average bear.
Situational awareness. If there's a bear there, I am not safe. How can I help stabilize the patient?
Thank you. Yes.
So anyway, these were called flying ambulances, by the way.
Okay.
These carts, these wheelbarrows.
Okay.
That would either bring you a doctor or bring you to a doctor.
You would be protected, of course, if you did stop by the Good Samaritan law.
Really? Do you feel better now?
No.
At the start of the American Civil War, our situation for wounded on the battlefield was still not great. Like, we had these developments throughout history of, like, methods or even the concept. The wheelbarrow isn't really the key development here. It's the idea that you should remove wounded from the battlefield mm-hmm. as quickly as possible. That was the concept that was revolutionary and saved lives.
For most of history, there had to be a certain fatalism here that, like, why? Like, it's
right.
It's
we can't
low pride
do much.
Because you're probably going to get gangrene. You're probably going to get an infection. You're probably going
to
die.
And we want to focus on the soldiers who are well and able to, whatever wounds they may have sustained, they're able to easily return from the battlefield.
Right.
Those are the ones we want to focus on, as opposed to put a lot of time and energy into people when we don't know how to fix them anyway. And at the beginning of the Civil War, that's kind of the attitude you see. When I read this, it made sense, I guess, as I think about it. But then I thought, like, by today's standards, this is crazy. Wounded were left on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. If you were injured and you couldn't leave, you were left there.
That's rough. That's a rough way to
that's
wind
a terrible,
things down.
Right. That's a terrible thought. But they didn't really have a good mechanism for removing people. They would assign certain people in the unit to go collect the wounded. But they were usually either, like, the company musicians.
Okay.
Or, like, soldiers that were thought of as, like, weak or not as, you know, like, well, they don't really do much, so we'll just give them this job. And a lot of the time, the people who were assigned this job wouldn't do it because they were running into the line of fire.
Right.
And putting their lives in danger.
I signed up to play the fife.
Exactly. I mean, that's like the drummer or the fife player.
And
like,
I'm
you're
good
telling
at it.
That, like,
I'm
they don't even have a gun, and you're telling them to run out there and.
My fife. Like, I'm great at fife.
So,
you don't want to lose that.
So this wasn't always performed. And so a lot of people were just wounded and left on the battlefield unless they could get themselves off, unless they could crawl back or somehow, you know, get themselves off the battlefield. After the Battle of Bull Run, some soldiers walked 27 miles from the battlefield to Washington to receive treatment.
Jeez,
the lucky ones who were well enough to do so. Mm-hmm. Dr. Jonathan Letterman was the first one to revolutionize this system in 1862 with a really simple idea. Why don't we assign soldiers to be what kind of would be considered medics? Mm-hmm. They weren't called that necessarily, but here's some basic things you can do in the field to stabilize people. Your job is a stretcher bearer. Your job is just to walk out with these soldiers, put people on stretchers and carry them back. And then he also helped to establish, again, these sort of hospital-like units up at the front where you could get these patients to quickly, stabilize them, and then hopefully by an ambulance, train, or boat, you could transfer them to a bigger, you know, medical center. if that made sense. So this was like the beginnings of what we see echoed in, you know, war situations today. Mm-hmm. In 1864, Congress passed the Ambulance Corps Act. This was also called an act to establish a uniform system of ambulances in the armies of the U.S. So this was just kind of codifying what Letterman had already started doing, which was, we need ambulances. We need ways to transport wounded off the battlefield routinely. Mm-hmm. We need a system for this. This is going to save lives. And we need places for them to go initially to be stabilized, and then bigger hospitals for them to go to after that. And at this point, all these ambulances fell under military jurisdiction, basically. Mm-hmm. So this was the beginning of the ambulance. It was just a military vehicle.
Okay.
And right now we're still
war,
talking
what
about
what is it
like,
good for? Apparently ambulances.
A lot of medical advances, yeah, as we have talked about. So after the Civil War, you had this concept of some sort of transport vehicle to take wounded or sick people to a hospital. But it had been under, you know, government military jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of hospitals who were like, this is probably a good service to have in general. Mm-hmm. I would like to keep this. And so this started actually at what is now Cincinnati General, was the first place to have an ambulance.
Oh,
like
wow.
A private ambulance that would go pick you up and take you there.
Mm-hmm.
And this was to replace exactly what I talked about, the doctor who showed up at your house to make a house call with just their, you know, their black bag, the classic doctor, a little black bag thing, which would have had all the tools available to them in the day prior to, by now in history, we have a lot more things we can do for people, a lot more medicines we can give and reasons to go to the hospital. This was quickly followed by, in New York, they had a really big, this was probably the biggest ambulance system at the time, Edward B. Dalton, who had been an army surgeon.
Like the bookseller? B. Dalton bookseller? That's a book. That's a chain. Probably not. Probably a different cat.
I have no idea.
Maybe they're related.
I don't know. We can look into that.
Justin can
Google that.
Those may not. Justin, we'll Google it. Go ahead, Sid.
But he started an ambulance service at Bellevue. And so it started in 1869 and very, very quickly increased to a lot of calls, a lot of services being provided. The other hospitals in New York also started providing ambulance service. So New York kind of led the mm-hmm. trail on this. They would, at the time, assign doctors or surgeons to the ambulances to go with them. So mm-hmm. at the time you asked me, did doctors go out with it? Well, they did at the time. And the vehicles had like stretchers, they had handcuffs and straitjackets, because a lot of the early patients were psychiatric patients that people would call and say, help, I have someone with a psychiatric illness. I'm worried that they're a threat to themselves or to somebody else, and I don't mm-hmm. know what to do. And so that was a lot of the early ambulance calls.
I have an update on B. Dalton Bookseller.
Okay.
It was founded by a man named Bruce Dayton.
Uh-huh.
Who just changed the Y to an L because it connotated, the name B. Dalton connotated quality, dependability, and authority.
I wonder if that's...
He just changed it.
I wonder if that's because of the ambulance guy.
Probably not. That would be quite a pull, honestly.
Is Dalton more dependable than Dayton?
Apparently, yeah. B. Dayton is nothing. B. Dalton. Ooh.
Ooh.
Dependable.
Tell that to everybody quality. Who lives in Dayton. They would disagree with you.
True.
So in the ambulance, in addition to the doctor, I thought it'd be interesting to know, like, what would you have had if you had gotten an ambulance to your house in the 1890s? In addition to a doctor or surgeon, you and maybe a straitjacket and some handcuffs, you have a box with brandy, 2 tourniquets, 6 bandages, sponges, splint material, and a small bottle of persulfate of iron.
Hmm.
And basically that's what they brought to you. And you would have a driver who earned about $500 a year for doing this.
Nice. Yeah. Or not. I actually have no idea.
And they even had like special harnesses that were easy to attach the horses to the vehicles, because these were still horse drawn at the time. Mm-hmm. Very quickly. So you could get a call and instantly harness your horse to the carriage and go. And then you also, like, if you were an ambulance driver, you got room and board because you needed to be there all the time.
Sure.
The doctors who were initially assigned this job didn't like it because you didn't make a lot of money. So they started filling the job by making residents who were still in training do this as a rotation. So they had to do this for 6 months before they completed their training.
Falling in the grand tradition of misusing resident labor.
Exactly, exactly. We can't have doctors do it, so we'll force doctors. Well, they're doctors. We'll force doctors in training.
Don't
we can't
reinforce
have doctors who are out of training.
Stereotype. The residents,
you know what I mean?
Doctors.
We can't have attendings do it, so we'll force residents to do it because we don't want to do it. But the schedule and the salary offered, although this sounds like exactly like a resident situation, so you got $50 a month, you did 12-hour shifts, and you got one day off every 4 weeks.
Yikes.
So that's all the residents would get.
That's rough.
And this by the way, this continued as late as 1935 in some places. They were still getting like $50 a month in 1935, the same salary they were getting in like 1869.
That's ludicrous.
Yeah, shit. If you can believe that.
Now, Sid, I love horses as much as the next guy who does a podcast that's largely about horses. but I want to hear about the motorized ones, like the ones we have today.
Well, we're going to get into that, Justin, but first let's head to the billing department.
Let's go. The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth. So you were going to tell me about horseless ambulances, Sydney.
That's right. So
which is a wild distinction if you think about it. We don't really think about horseless. There's lots of things that are horseless, really.
Yeah.
What, sad what as else, that may be.
What else, Justin? What else is do you want to make a list of horseless things?
Well, okay. My computer is kind of a horseless adding machine.
True. Is that what you use your computer for? Adding?
It's a horseless adding machine. Mm-hmm. Mike, our coffee maker is a horseless coffee maker.
The shower is a horseless shower.
It's a horseless shower, if you can believe it.
It would be less effective if there was a horse in it.
Friends, start throwing horseless on to the beginning of objects that don't have horses involved and see if they don't sound pretty impressive.
And then see what your friends think of that, too.
Yeah. Go ahead and use the horseless speaking device in front of you, Sydney, and continue.
So the first horseless ambulance was introduced actually in Chicago in 1899. And it's funny because like New York got it like the year after. All this talk about like New York and Dalton and Bellevue and everything. And then they were a year late. This became the norm. And again, a lot of the use was military still. So throughout World War One, a lot of different cars were tried, like Model T ambulances and different things. Like they were expanding as the automobile developed. So too did the ambulance. There was a thought this far back that, you know, maybe actually even before World War One, there was a thought as far back as 1870 that air transport might be better as an ambulance than ground transport.
I'm not so sure about that.
So, but what were they using back then? It's 1870. What kind of
Zeppelins?
Hot air balloons.
Okay. Oh, I wasn't that far off. That's fun.
A Dutchman named De Mooy came up with the idea of a hot air balloon. You would suspend a giant stretcher under the balloon, and then to move it in the right direction, horses would pull it. And then you could get them evacuated faster. This actually was used. He got the idea during the Siege of Paris, and after that, 160 French soldiers and citizens were transported this way in 1870.
You know, that's fun. Just because you're hurt doesn't mean you can't have a little fun. So, a little whimsy.
So air transport was used surprisingly early. In World War One, airplanes were also introduced. So you actually had real flying ambulances services at mm-hmm. that point. We didn't see helicopters come along until World War Two. And classically, I think all of us are giant MASH fans, right?
Sure, of course.
And so we know that helicopters were kind of the mainstay for a lot of quick air evacuations of wounded, you know, mm-hmm. once they were developed in Korea and in Vietnam as well. The use of ambulances by civilians was not really regulated and expanded until the late 60s and 70s.
That's kind of a new idea, huh?
Yeah, that recently. Because they really didn't have like a standardization of it until then. The military had their methods, but as far as in civilian use, you know, for your communities, who was in charge of this service? Who ran it? Mm-hmm. We didn't yet have the concept of an EMT. So, you know, what were the ambulances for? It was just a car that took you to the hospital.
Right.
And so it could be run by your local police department. It could be run by your local fire department. And whoever ran it would also staff it. So you would have a police officer staffing the ambulance as well.
Wow.
So as you could imagine, they couldn't provide a lot of medical care.
Right.
Really. for a while, communities that could not afford ambulance services relied on the local funeral home.
Oh, well, that's convenient, because if it doesn't pan out, you're already in there.
Exactly.
Oh, God. I didn't mean to be ghoulish. Ugh.
And you might wonder, like, how in the world, and this was very common. This is not, like, just a couple little places. There were a lot of places, and this happened all the way up until, like, the 70s in some very small, isolated communities, where the local funeral home would be who you would call if you had an emergency and needed transport to the hospital. There are probably people listening to this podcast who still remember this. The reason is an ambulance had to be big enough to accommodate a person lying down. In most communities, what is the only place that has vehicles built to accommodate someone lying down?
Ice cream trucks.
Do you often lie down in an ice cream truck?
You could, is what I'm saying.
Right, but it's not made for that, you know?
Sure. Okay, fine.
The way a hearse is kind of made to accommodate a person who is permanently lying down.
Got it.
Right. So anyway, the hearse was a good fit. So funeral directors would offer ambulance services. And if you think about it, this was a good gimmick for them, because you don't commonly have, like, on your refrigerator, on a list of important numbers, like, nobody does that anymore, but we used to have, like, a list of emergency numbers on your refrigerator. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't usually have a funeral home, right?
Right.
That seems a little depressing.
But if they were the ambulance,
then you certainly would. And so it was a great gimmick for funeral directors to community engagement. You became relied on. You became valued members of the community, and not just like that thing you don't want to think about.
Yeah, like decreepify the whole thing a little bit. I can
exactly.
Get that.
And they should do something again
to get back in the game with maybe like also cotton candy. Like also we do sell cotton candy.
I don't.
And batteries. That seems... A lot of times I need batteries, and it would just be super convenient if there's a place that I could go get cotton candy and batteries and something else sometime at one point for other people, but not me ever. And that would be convenient.
They were actually kind of reluctant to give up this because of the good feelings that it generated in the community. And like you said, if things didn't work out in transport, they would just take you straight to the funeral home, so they got your business.
You think there's any unscrupulous ones, like kind of the long way around? Maybe. Oh no, I'm stuck in traffic.
No, there weren't that. But like there was a lot of dry cleaning. I got into this deep hole where I was reading about unscrupulous funeral home practices at the time, like back in like the mid 1900s and things. And anyway, so the thing is though, the Interstate Commerce Commission started regulating how ambulance drivers they started treating them like long haul truckers. Mm. It's certain hours that they could work and they had to be off, and they had standards for like the rest in between shifts and how well they were paid and all these different things. And that was very cumbersome for funeral homes who were kind of just using like friends. Like once your kid was old enough to drive, let them be the hearse ambulance driver.
Yeah.
Like they weren't really standardizing this. Mm. They were just kind of doing it as a nice thing for the neighborhood. And then there was this big white paper report from the National Academy of Sciences that came out in the 60s that said there was an increase in morbidity and mortality from inadequate ambulance services. Basically, we could be saving more lives if communities just had a decent ambulance instead of having to rely on whoever. Not knocking the funeral homes, just acknowledging that like this is not what they should be doing. And after that white paper report, the EMTs became a thing, emergency medical technician, you know, the whole idea that we need people who are trained to do this came into being, and higher standards for what an ambulance could be. And so it was actually good for the funeral homes because they didn't want to disappoint and let down the communities that they'd promised to serve, but it became so cumbersome to do it that when they finally were told they couldn't anymore, it was like, well, if you insist, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But like I said, in some communities, the 70s, they were still doing this.
Wow.
What followed along with this is obviously advances in what we could do in an ambulance. Mm. There's no point in having an ambulance if you can't do, I mean, like if it's just a car to drive you to the hospital.
Right.
But with the, you know, improvements in CPR and pre-hospital patient care and like the development of portable oxygen, you know, and all kinds of medications we can administer and fluids and everything we can do in the back of an ambulance, once we developed that, it made more sense to have vehicles that could accommodate it and personnel that could staff it. Mm-hmm. So medical care really necessitated, you know, once we could do these things, then it necessitated the development of better ambulances. And now if you've been in the back of an ambulance, you know, it's like a mini hospital.
Yeah.
Right. And you have to have people who know what they're doing to staff them. You couldn't just have anybody who had a car. What's interesting about this currently is that, and then this would not replace the ambulance service, but car services like Uber and Lyft are getting into the medical transport business. You may have seen there was a big article about how Uber's doing this. This just came out a few weeks ago, I think. Mm-hmm. Uber is now offering to charge doctor's offices to go get patients and bring them to their appointments. Mm-hmm. So it's free to the patient.
The doctors pick up the tab.
Exactly. And you might wonder, why would they do that? Because it's cheaper to pay for an Uber ride than it is to lose that appointment slot. The money that the office loses by having like a no-show in that slot is way more than it would cost to just send the Uber driver out and get them.
I like the no-shows, though, because it means that you could might have like 10 minutes to eat lunch. So that would be great.
That's true. Those no-shows are how I eat breakfast and lunch. They're the only reason I ever get to drink coffee or pee. And also for those of us who have to pump at work, sometimes lunch breaks and no-shows are the only times you get to
keep those no-shows coming. Folks, book an appointment with your doctor you do not intend on keeping.
No, I'm not advocating that.
But my
office manager would kill me for this.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's the only chance. But anyway, and Lyft actually was already offering the service. All these articles about Uber, I didn't realize Lyft had been doing this, but they're both getting into the business. And then the thought is like, you know, for a lot of communities, like for instance, in parts of our surrounding area, not in the city, but in the more rural parts of this area, you might wait 45 minutes for an ambulance.
Yes, Sydney, but in the more rural parts of this area, how much longer are you going to be waiting for an Uber?
Well, that's fair. I'm just saying there's an opportunity here for non-emergent patients who don't actually need an ambulance, because you see that a lot. People
right.
who need to get to the hospital but don't really need an ambulance but don't have a way to get there, and they can't wait till the next day, so they use an ambulance. There's an opening in here. There's a small opening for these people. And I mean, we've been doing this. We give patients taxi vouchers already. So this is an easy way, paperless, you know, to do this.
I should clarify. We do have an Uber.
We have,
an Uber.
An Uber slash Lyft.
Ted's Uber. He put a sign up on his car.
He did.
It's an Uber and a Lyft, whatever you need.
I think we have two.
We have two now.
I think we might have two now.
Okay, well, you're covered, because they can each work 12-hour shifts and cover all of Huntington. Folks, that's going to do it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your continued support of our program. We certainly do appreciate it very much. I wanted to mention, we've got a... if you want to buy a Sawbones t-shirt, we've got a couple of them available, and that's going to be in our new merch store, which should be going live on Monday. You can go to McElroyMerch.com, and when that is working, that address will also be functional. And I want to say thanks to the Maximum Fun Network for having us as part of their extended family. I want to tell you, we've got a new two new podcasts on the Max Fun Network. Everything's coming up, Simpsons podcast, and Jonah Radio featuring my buddy Jonah Ray. And both of those shows are going to be on the Maximum Fun Network, maxfun.org. Of course, you can find them on iTunes or what have you. So go for it. And folks, that is going to do it for us for this week. Actually, I did want to mention, we got a few nice gifts in the P.O. box yesterday that I wanted to thank people for.
In the meantime, Cooper has pooped again, just in case.
She has pooped again, in case you're tracking that. On a spreadsheet. Thank you to Sam for the book, Angie for the blankets and pillow monster, Scrappy Lynn for the doll and booties. Hanny sent Pliny, delicious Pliny the Elder, which Sydney can drink again. Suzanne for a book called Jack's New Smile, which is about cleft palate. All proceeds from that actually go to help families affected by cleft palate. So check that book out. Leah sent mugs. Adam sent coffee. Paul sent a book for Charlie. Kelsey sent booties and a hat. And Catherine sent books. So thank you to y'all for the gifts. It's very nice. I can see our
from
third
Charlie as well.
Yeah. And our third co-host has started to get a little grouchy. So we're going to wrap it right there. So until next time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.